Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Yes, we are burning down the house. I am Curtis B. Wayne here on heritageradionetwork.org. Today I want to continue the conversation that we had last week with David Bergman, who is a Yale architect, Yale-educated architect, who, while his undergraduate experience dipped him in economics.
That's right.
And I find that very interesting because my undergraduate experience, although it was ostensibly a B-arch, we got a lot into city planning and town planning, which was an artifact, I suppose, of the old regime of architecture in the 1970s. You're a little bit younger.
Only a little bit.
But at that time, when I was in school, it was understood that architects would be the city planners. Mm-hmm. And but we didn't get into economics at all. So without any particular order, I'd like to put forth the things that I'd like to talk about. Okay. I'd like to talk about the unintended consequences of city planning decisions, cars over mass transit. I'd like to talk about what you probably know better than any of us about the hidden subsidies of the suburban lifestyle. I have discovered that a lot of our younger colleagues don't know about the not-so-hidden conspiracy between and amongst Firestone, Goodyear, and GM to wipe out mass transit in L.A.,
yeah,
right? With the government's blind eye.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of versions of that story.
Yes, yeah. And anything else that might come up.
Okay.
But before we waltz off into that conversation, let's have 20 seconds or 30 of a waltz from the last century from Richard Strauss.
Every August for the past 10 years, Heritage Foods USA has had the great honor of announcing the arrival of a new generation of Good Shepherd Ranch heritage turkeys and a new chapter in the history of an endangered species. You have to eat them to save them. While many farmers now use the term, Frank Reese and his team raised the truest example of the original heritage turkey. According to the USDA, they remain the only farm allowed to use the name Heritage on their label. We hope you reserve your healthy, naturally mating, flying, standard bronze, bourbon red, white Holland, slate, black, or Narragansett turkey today. Let's do it again and support the brightest hope for the turkey. We guarantee these are the best tasting turkeys ever, or your money back. Prices start at $75. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This, and well, that was a very interesting non sequitur between Richard Strauss and Heritage Foods USA. What we were waltzing into, I thought, was a conversation about how it was that civil governance, I don't mean necessarily on a federal level, but certainly in the case of Los Angeles, was seduced almost in a dance to the notion that, yes, they should encourage more roads and fewer trolleys, fewer streetcars. Tell us the story about that.
Well, I think it's a, I don't know that I know the story, but there are several intertwined ones. The one of the larger format stories has to do, and perhaps on a federal level as well as local, with the belief that everything good that was going to come in the American growth period, in the American economy, had to do with consumption. And that meant buying and making a whole lot of things. And in the middle of the century, it meant a whole lot of cars and a whole lot of roads, among other things. Yeah, that was all seen as great.
Yeah, but in L.A., nobody was making cars. They were all a Detroit or Akron. You know, tires came from Akron and cars came from Detroit.
Well, that's how we saw this as often federally subsidized.
Uh-huh. Go on.
Okay. Well, there have been many, many programs, again, at the federal level and sometimes at the more local level, that encouraged this suburban sprawl or less urban version of L.A. And I've actually found myself talking about this a lot just in recent weeks. Sort of interesting that you bring it up. And it has to do with those incentives for industry. It has to do with the introduction of the mortgage deduction, which encouraged people, of course, to buy single-family houses.
Right.
And the two of those together combined to bring us to suburban sprawl, really. It was de-emphasizing the urban centers in terms of investing in cities, de-emphasizing mass transit systems because individualized transport somehow seemed, well, did seem better for the economy and evolved into seeming better for the American spirit, if you will.
Well, it was better if industry was going to expand to previously undeveloped areas instead of having to retrofit old industrial plants that didn't necessarily fit the new economy.
You're talking about in terms of car production?
In terms of any production. If you're going to have, let me think, circa 1947.
So post-war?
Right. If you were going to make draperies, you probably wouldn't find a plant that could take yards and yards and yards of goods from shipped across country on the train and stitch them together into drapes in a factory in central L.A. You'd have to move out into the desert, build a cheap structure, and start a new company. But that meant that you would have to have people who would be able to get there, which means that they would have to have a car.
I don't think it necessarily worked that direction, and you may have another thought on this. My impression of suburban expansion is it was people moving out for living, for residence first, and then to a lesser extent, companies following.
Yes, possibly. My own experience was that my dad, after the war, learned of a place where there were brand new houses that he and his war buddies could buy using their GI Bill.
Right.
He had no interest in going back to school.
And just to interrupt, the GI Bill again was another part of that incentive to have your own home.
After World War II, there were incentives given to returning GIs, and they could either spend a certain stipend on education, or they could use that stipend on buying a house.
Right.
And my father was one of the older veterans. He was, at the end of the war, he was 36 years old, and he had already industrial experience, and so he was able to have a job without going to college and getting a degree. So he bought a house, and where he's still living and held on to that $18,000 house, it would have been worth, last time that property traded hands, about $700,000.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if you take that just a few years later, because I'm not that much younger than you are, my father, for instance, grew up here in Fort Washington, city kid through and through. And 3 months after I was born, our house was finished up in Rockland County. So that was the exodus. That was what, you know, you were supposed to do. And one of the things And one of the things I find interesting is how that evolved into what you were supposed to do. Because now, when we talk about some of the things we want to do for environmental purposes, it's often attacked as against the American way of life. And what I've been thinking about a lot lately is, well, how did that come to be the American way of life?
Yeah, what is the American way of life?
Yeah.
I mean, is it to do for your own and live close to your means, or is it to consume?
And is it to be in a community with interacting with your fellow Americans or others, or is it this independence of living out in the woods on your own self-sufficiently?
Yeah, but in the suburban version of that, you're living out in the woods self-sufficiently, but not.
Right.
But with a car, and you might or might not have something to do with your neighbors.
So in a sense, you're getting neither the out in the woods independence or the community.
Yeah. Let's get back to the story of L.A.
Okay.
Because I think that's, I think that in terms of an economic story is really interesting in this era when we are hypersensitized to, in our current election, there are some who would say that the parties have been bought. If you don't want to talk about it, we could have a little musical break. Let's talk about the clockwork of economics. Burning Down the House, I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here with David Bergman, an architect who, in addition to his education at Yale, had some economic education at Princeton. You were saying that you're aware of the story of GM and LA, but you're not feeling authoritative about it.
Yeah, I mean, I know enough to get me into trouble.
Just tell me. We love getting into trouble here.
And speaking of getting into trouble, by the way, just to clarify, the Princeton was just the MArch, the architecture. All the economics occurred back undergraduate days.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
I got that inverted. I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Stern.
it was pre-Mr. Stern, too.
Oh, who was there then?
God, I'm trying to remember who was the dean.
We're talking about Yale Architecture School, which is an MArch program.
But I was in the undergraduate BA program, so I was a little less tied into the school, and that's why I can't actually recall who was dean.
No. I thought you got your...
You said Stern. That would be Yale.
Yes. You were undergraduate Yale, and you got your MArch at Princeton.
Right.
All right.
We're getting
one under the aura of Vin Scully and the ghost of Paul Rudolph.
Yes.
Lurking about that Greystone Manor there and at the corner of Church and Chapel or wherever that is.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yes. And then you went and submitted yourself to
into the pastoral settings of
Princeton. How many years before the mast under Mr. McGraves?
He was teaching there. You know, he's never been under his mast. He's never been dean. He was definitely one of my studio profs.
And how long were you there?
3 years for the master.
Yes, well, yeah. 3 years before the mast, being tormented by Michael Graves. I salute you, sir. But let's talk about economics. Well, yeah, you know, if you don't want to talk about Yale, that's fine.
No, I do. I love Yale.
And if you don't want to talk about L.A., that's also fine. But I do want to talk about the economics of growth and the hidden cost of city planning or landscape-wide planning decisions that were perhaps inadvertently made that has left us with the Pax Americana, where we have thousands upon thousands of cities that don't work without cars. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
How do you think that came about?
I think, again, it has to do with intentional or unintentional federal programs that ended up subsidizing the growth of that whole means of movement. Again, this individualized, you know, having your own personal means of movement, the car. And, you know, now when a lot of people look at more urban-oriented programs or programs for mass transit, they attack them and say, well, they're not self-sufficient. You have to give them so much subsidy. That means, you know, that's not the way we want to do things.
Yeah,
so subsidizing.
That is very funny, yes. Yeah. And yet, our federal income tax goes towards subsidizing the road system.
That's right. And you can look at how the interstate highway system was built with, I think it was 90% federal funding.
Oh, yes.
You know, localities had to put in very little. But you wouldn't see that happening at that kind of, anywhere near that level for, say, Amtrak.
Well, no, because if I may now insert what I've learned, railroads were given at the beginning of World War II. And when the Supreme Allied Commander, Dwight Eisenhower, returned from his conquest of the Nazi Empire, he was very much impressed by the autobahns, which could move massive amounts of wheeled vehicles very quickly, much faster than railroads. And he determined that it was a matter of national defense that we should have an autobahn system. Yeah. And they called that, initially, they called that the Eisenhower system.
And it was called the Interstate Highway Defense System.
Yes.
Yeah, it was all, that was its starting point, was we needed it for national defense.
Yes. And when we were looking at the specter of Russian bombers coming over the pole, first with conventional bombs and then with atom bombs, the idea that we needed to be able to evacuate cities very quickly through a road system because rail would take too long, and rail is very efficient when things are regular, but when things are irregular, you can get everybody into vehicles and just head them out on the highways very quickly.
As opposed to highways being irregularly jammed, right?
Well, they didn't know what the unintended consequences of that. But at the time, 65 years ago or so, it seemed like a great idea in terms of national defense.
I suppose you could also make a parallel argument that just decentralizing industry and decentralizing populations out of urban centers would follow that same logic.
Absolutely. You can't just drop a bomb on Chicago and wipe out all industrial product because industry in Chicago in 1959 was spread out all over the suburban area, or in L.A. was even more dispersed. So you couldn't destroy economic base of a city,
and the irony
was so dispersed.
And the irony, of course, we know now that wasn't being realized. Well, one of the ironies is that made us dependent on other countries in terms of fueling that dispersion.
Well, in the beginning, And if you look at the history of the 20th century, you'll see that for most of the 20th century, United States was the oil producer. So that was not a consideration.
That's true. Yeah.
It was just when the reality of geology sunk in and it became apparent that we didn't have enough oil and this was not going to go on forever, that became a problem.
I wrote a piece in my blog a few weeks ago, which I mentioned last week, Eco-Optimism.
Yes.
And I was trying to draw a parallel there.
Feel free to flog that.
Okay, ecooptimism.com.
Eco-Optimism. All one word.
All one word.
Dot blog.
Dot com.
Dot com.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in it, I looked at the history of the manufacturing of rubber.
Mm.
And tried to draw, and did draw, I think, parallels between that and oil, which in and of itself has its irony, rubber being now made of oil. But in the beginning of World War II, the government realized that our supplies of latex to make natural rubber were endangered by sea routes. Basically had to go past Japan to get our sources of latex, and that wasn't going to happen.
We weren't getting it from South America?
Oh, that had that ended quite a while ago. Originally, it came from Brazil and the regions around there. By the turn of into the 20th century, they had successfully figured out how to grow it in Southeast Asia.
Uh-huh.
And there was very little being grown in the Amazon by that point. So it already shifted once.
Uh-huh.
Then in World War II, since we couldn't really get things from Southeast Asia, the government embarked on this huge program in which they basically told industries and told universities and chemists that you need to find, you will find ways to make synthetic rubber because the military needed it. It was essential,
yes,
one of those
course.
Elements like steel.
Sure.
And within a matter of a short, very short period, we had a synthetic rubber industry that within a few years after the war had almost completely supplanted the natural rubber sources.
So you're telling me that if I were to rent a Zip car, because I've sold my car.
Me too, yeah.
The tires are synthetic rubber?
Well, actually, the interesting thing I've read is that radial tires, when those were introduced a bunch of decades ago, they actually are more dependent on natural rubber, so it's a mix of the two.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the larger demands, I believe, and here might be one of those areas where I know enough to get me into trouble again.
Okay.
But I believe that tires are one of the areas now that use a fair amount of natural rubber versus synthetic, but we use it in all kinds of other areas. My point being, though, that under the necessities of war, the government was able to step in and say, we're going to figure out another way to do this, because we have to.
Well,
in the name of, in the national interest.
Yes.
And why aren't we doing the same thing? Well, we can talk about it in terms of urban policy, but I'm thinking more specifically about energy. I know I took you a course there astray.
No. I mean, I don't want to get into the age thing yet again, but we had a president by the name of Carter here in the United States. Those of you listening from overseas, you need to quick go to your Wikipedia about Jimmy Carter, Georgia-born former naval officer, submarine commander.
Yeah.
Who, when he was elected, made his
the Malaise speech.
Top priority that energy sufficiency was equivalent to war, and he mandated through executive action that federal buildings should not be cooled to any cooler than 80 degrees Fahrenheit, and.
He put solar panels on the White House.
And it was a flop.
Well, after Reagan removed them.
No, but the movement that he wished to have started was a flop.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of popular sort of hippie-level support for solar energy, but the technology just wasn't there.
The technology wasn't there, but I think we can also argue in retrospect that he may have taken, or the movement may have taken the wrong approach at the time. I'm sure you remember, and I am old enough to remember the speech where he introduced a lot of this, in which he sat in front of a fireplace wearing a cardigan sweater.
Yes. Yeah.
As a way of saying, let's just lower the heat and dress a little more warmly.
Yes.
And, you know,
Would have been fine if we were actually at war with Saudi Arabia, but we weren't.
We weren't, and therefore...
It just looked kind of goofy.
It looked kind of goofy, but it emphasized a direction of environmentalism that I think has proven itself to be a problem, which is the idea that we are going to have to sacrifice and give up a lot of things.
And Americans don't like to sacrifice unless it's actually hitting them in terms of boys and now young women who aren't coming home.
Yeah.
Or bombs falling, which has not happened since like 1813.
Well, if you ignore 9/11, but yeah.
That really didn't get the let's get environmental thing really going.
No, it certainly didn't.
No, that was a political attack against New York and our populist culture, didn't really have anything to do with energy and...
But even that didn't get us into the...
And W didn't spin it into an energy thing.
Well, that's into an energy thing or even any kind of sacrifice for a war purpose, mm-hmm. even though we were attacked. We pulled off this war, supposedly wars, without sacrifice in terms of our lifestyles or even taxes.
No, tax didn't go up. Deficit spending went up. But we didn't have a war because there wasn't anyone that we could declare war on.
Yeah, that's I know.
Because it was a non-governmental organization that had decided to make war on us. And
I didn't mean to draw too much of a parallel.
Inevitably it must come up. We were attacked, but what it interestingly resulted in was because of the spunk of New Yorkers in the aftermath of that attack, is that everyone wanted to come to New York, and New York real estate prices rose steadily over the next 8 or so years, if you look at...
faster than national averages.
Oh, yeah.
Because we were still in the bubble at that point.
No, in 2001, in my experience at least, construction was kind of flat.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, there was this enormous desire for housing. And we saw all of these high-rise condo, some rental towers being built. I was a part of fueling that industry from 2003 through 2008. And there was enormous economic energy in New York City, satisfying a desire for people who wanted to move into New York City.
And isn't that an interesting reaction to the city being attacked? I mean,
we both know lots
of people who pulled their families out of the city.
And then there were others who said, I want to be there because these people have an indomitable spirit.
Hmm. I know I certainly, in my neighborhood of the Lower East Side, since 9/11... in that boom you're talking about. It's totally transformed. We see high-rise buildings.
Yeah.
In the Lower East Side, high-rise. You know, nothing really above 6 stories existed before the 21st century.
Right, because that was the limit of a walk-up.
And the market.
Yeah. And there was the... you live on Rivington Street or something like that?
Eldridge, actually. Nearby it.
That was in the late 1990s, still a very unregulated, drug-driven economy.
I actually moved there to that street in 82, And the week I moved in, the New York Times had an article that was the drug supermarkets of New York City.
Right.
And one of them was the corner of Eldridge and Rivington, a block away from me.
Right. And so we can only look at this, I think, unless someone wants to do sociology on the phenomenon, but that empirically we can say that after September 11th, 2001, New York changed substantially, mm-hmm. and for the better.
Yeah, not the way you might have expected.
No. New Yorkers led the way in showing that Americans will not be defeated by random acts of violence.
Do you think that was a conscious thing?
No.
Yeah.
No, I think it's just a matter of... My theory of American history is that we, Yankees, you know, you could be Ecuadorian American, but if you speak more or less standard broadcast English, or me from Chicago, mm-hmm. and step off a plane in Paris and go to a brasserie and run into some Australians.
Okay. Sounds good so far.
You're a Yank.
Yeah.
As the other English-speaking people in the world view us. Yeah, I mean, you... And that obliterates whether you're Lutheran or Jewish, mm-hmm. or Catholic, mm-hmm. or Buddhist. If you're an American, you're a Yank. So I think that there is a Yankee spirit of... Don't get in our way. Part two is, my theory is that Yanks do the right thing, but probably for the wrong reason.
And probably not at first. It might take them a while to get there.
Yes, yeah. Eventually. Mm-hmm. Now, if we turn that back into suburban development...
Yeah. All right, let's bring us back here.
...and economics, at the time, everybody... Not just us, but if you read Corbusier, he was totally in love with the automobile. If you read about the Italian futurists, they were totally in love with high-speed travel. Mm-hmm. It was all out there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just us. We led the way. Mm-hmm. And
actually, did we, though, if the Autobahns pre-existed?
Yes, but we... took to the automobile, yeah. sooner than anybody else because of Henry Ford,
right.
making mass-produced Model T, yeah, automobiles.
Yeah, yeah, which changed everything.
I mean, the, Mercedes-Benz, the Benz, the Daimler-Benz company had automobiles 15 years before, mm-hmm. Henry Ford, but they didn't make it a mass,
right.
product.
Right, right, or affordable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of the same.
Right.
Right. And, you know, we took an idea and we multiplied it and we took it to the limit. Back when I was in undergraduate school, my dean, John Haydick, mm-hmm. often said that he thought that the Italians were the most futuristic people. And he was probably thinking about futurism,
right.
and Santa Lea,
right.
and all that stuff. Which,
and that, of course, goes back all the way to World War I.
Yes. And for those of you who are civilians who are listening to this, I'm sorry. Antonio, I think, Santa Lea, drew these fantastic drawings of mega structures and streaking automobiles or something going through the landscape, and then even into even into the 1950s, you had people who were architects and would be city planners supposing that town planning wasn't about a sense of place but rather a sense of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that movement was what all society was about. To which I can only say, well, when you stop moving, then where are you and what it's like?
Yeah, and what can you do while you're moving as opposed to while you're still?
Well, I think all these people imagined that movement was somehow instantaneous and you just pop from place to place to place to place. But then that puts the emphasis on the thrill of movement and not on the repose of being in a place.
And at the time, there was some thrill of movement, too. I mean, trains were still pretty nice to ride on, but think of the airlines at the time. That was an exciting thing to do to get
on a plane. Absolutely, yeah.
Hard to imagine now. You know, I'd rather sit on a train or walk than get on a plane.
So would I. When I went to Charleston, South Carolina over Memorial Day weekend, I took the train. I did not fly.
Wonderful, yeah.
It took me all day to get there, but nobody hassled me. I had no hassles whatsoever. Right. Yes, it was all day. It didn't matter. I anticipated it.
And you can walk around.
Oh, yeah, I got up. I could go to the bathroom. There was nobody patted me down.
Yeah. We actually looked into doing that. We went to New Orleans earlier this year, and it just was that much further that it didn't make sense.
But further to the point, because it is a lengthy journey, anything that would be abnormal would have been detected. And so it is not like the anonymous experience of air flight begs for random acts of violence.
Oh, interesting, the psychology of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jack, let's take another 10 seconds or so and get back to economics.
Right.
What you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Didn't follow that.
1, 2, 3, 4, tell me that you love me more. Who benefits? This is Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne talking about economics, sort of, and the built environment with David Bergman, architect, and thinker of big thoughts. 1, 2, 3, 4, tell me who benefits from the economics of exurban expansion?
Well, I think we've acknowledged already that a lot of it is industrially driven. You know, which inevitably gets it intertwined with politicians and therefore benefits of that sort. I think the bigger question, I'm not sure this is where you're going, but bigger question is whether the people who are in it, the people living in suburbia or working in suburbia, are they we benefiting or not?
I don't even know if they're aware that they're benefiting. I think it's just, by this time, a given. Now, let's get back to the profession of architecture. You're going to have a house of your own sort of thing in one part has been very good for the sole practitioners who are going to do one-off houses. And there are a fair number of them. And if you look at the statistics of practice in the United States, you'd see that most architects are in very small firms.
Me being one of those.
Well, that's all right. Mm-hmm. And you mostly do one-offs, even if they are in urban areas.
Right.
Which is great. If you can make a living doing that plus something else, that's wonderful because you're able to bring your architectural education and experience to enliven and raise the level of happiness
for some,
for the people who are your clients.
Right.
Right. But the suburban expansion gave the potential for many more architects to be trained and many more architects to potentially bring a higher level of happiness to people living in this greatly expanded one-off world. But that's not what happened.
No. Well, for one thing, very little, in, you know, percentage-wise of that suburban great expansion was architected. You know, most houses in suburban developments really had no architect.
Oh, or they may have an architect who did 12 standard plans.
Right, that were repeated that were thousands. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
The house that I really grew up in, I don't remember the first place that we lived in, but when I was two, my parents moved to the house that my dad bought from the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was designed by an architect. When I was 19 or 20, I discovered the blueprints. They were blueprints.
Yeah, right, the old style.
In my dad's files of the house. And I looked at what the guy had designed. It was a guy, you know. And because there were very few women architects at the time. So,
well,
artifact of time. But what he had designed wasn't bad for the time. Mm-hmm. There was insulation above. It was a ranch house with a very flat slope, gable roof.
Uh-huh.
The roof was tar paper with aggregate stuck to it.
Yeah.
But at the attic level, there were at least 6 inches of mineral wool for insulation, but the walls had no insulation. They were steel sash casement windows that were very high, Frank Lloyd Wright style, because there were no views because it was suburbia. There was nothing to look at. The windows were only for daylight. But yet, they did a good job of bringing in daylight because they were way up at the ceiling height. I mean, so the guy did a pretty good job, given it was a cheap, cheap building.
But that's still, I think, fairly unusual that there was an architect doing just that plan for that one house. I mean, I grew up in a house that was architected also.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, almost was ashamed to admit for years that I wanted to be an architect because he did such a bad job, my family had to sue him.
I'm sorry
about
that.
I figured, what kind of a role model was that? Regardless, I think both of our houses were...
I mean, for all I know, the guy who designed our house may have studied with Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm-hmm. It was outside of Chicago, right? You know, Taliesin was up in Wisconsin. It's possible. I mean, he did a good job. They were very popular houses. Unfortunately, our house was, I suppose, in some cosmic sense, in a very good feng shui place. Mm-hmm. When I went back to see it, it had been wiped out and replaced by a McMansion.
There you go.
A 2.5-story fake brick and stone-clad piece of crap,
right,
replacing this pure post-war machine for living. You were saying, your house.
Actually, I sort of made the point on that one. It was architected. It was a one-off design, more or less. You know, we were fortunate. I grew up in a family. We were able to do that. But most of suburbia was not. I forget what the statistics are. Maybe, you know, 2 or 3% of homes are actually involving directly an architect.
Well, these days, yeah.
Even back then in the 50s and 60s in the big boom. And, you know, I grew up, by the way, I was, at the peak of the boom. My high school class was the biggest one. There were smaller classes before and after me, so I was there.
So you're born, like, in 62?
No, 56.
Really? That was the peak?
That's what I see in a lot of the numbers, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, the whole notion of whether architects are serving the 99% or the 1%. Is something that is going to be debated in Chicago, October 17, 18, and 19, the Congress of Residential Architecture, which is an organization comprised of builders, realtors, and architects. And I will be moderating the kickoff debate are we serving the 1% or the 90% or the 99% I think it's at the Marriott. I'm not sure.
Wish I could be there.
Well, if you get your plane reservation
or train
in early, it's only going to cost me about $500 to be out there to be their moderator. But this is a very critical thing. Who do we really serve? If you're a sole practitioner, you're serving very few.
Mm-hmm.
Should your higher value be to try to get yourself into a larger practice where you're doing big, big, big projects and you can...
Well, that would be one approach, but I think this actually ties neatly into something else that I was reading earlier this week. The story came out about we all know about this, I guess, the huge slump in the architectural profession.
Yeah.
And the particular article I read said that the buildings for architecture firms had fallen 40%. In, I think it was the last 10 years.
Not surprising.
And that 28% of positions in architecture firms had disappeared.
Not surprising.
So what that means, that even if you did make a decision that you were going to be able to accomplish more, give back more, whatever, working in a larger firm, doing larger scale stuff, that job probably isn't there. And where that takes us, I think, is into a discussion of, well, what can we, as a vastly overpopulated profession, and perhaps overtrained in some areas, what can we do if we're not directly architecting?
I would say overpopulated and undertrained.
Yeah, I thought twice as I said that.
It's all right. which we've talked about, that current architectural education, as it's given, is... overly focused on crap that doesn't really matter, that's driven by the so-called academics who are not practitioners.
Right, right.
Because the status quo in a lot of architecture schools right now is really focused on making, at least at the bachelor's level, a B arch equivalent to an art history degree.
But here's where I think we do have strengths, which is that architects, by definition, are a couple of things. We're visualizers, obviously.
Sure.
Right? And we're also optimists in that we're always...
Yeah, otherwise we wouldn't blindly go into
that's true.
Years and years and years of training with no hopes of employment.
That could just be poor judgment, but...
No, I think it's hardwired into us.
Yeah, I was thinking optimists in the sense that we see... something, a piece of land or a building or an object, and think, this could be better if we had this, or I designed that.
Absolutely.
And combine that with our ability to visualize and to communicate that, I think we architects are in a unique position to help us see these possible futures that will be better than where we are now.
And
we can influence.
Absolutely. And what tools do you think we need in order to be able to effectuate that?
Well, that's the good question, the tough question, because the tool isn't going to be building, because there's not going to be that much building. And I'm not sure that's
well,
not a
well,
bad
I'm
thing.
Well, I'm not sure that there's... Define building.
I was thinking in terms of, you know, new construction.
New construction.
Yeah, yeah. That,
yeah.
There will be a lot of renovation, changes of uses, infill.
Yes.
And I think that we can... play a large part in communicating how our lifestyles can be so much more interesting, how we can flourish as individuals, flourish as communities in these new urbanistic settings. You know, contrary to the American dream of the suburban individual home.
I'm glad. Well, I totally agree. I was talking to a friend of mine who's unhappy with her apartment because she feels that it's not spacious enough.
Mm-hmm.
She's a single woman who lives in, I haven't measured the apartment, but I would imagine that it's 1,500 square feet.
Seems good size to me, but yeah.
Yeah, and so what I said was, you can develop a sense of space by modulating light and where it's placed, so that you feel the space in which you're living. She says, well, that's a very interesting idea. That's just a small example of the things that we can do to modulate our given environment, whatever environment we're in. I mean, I lived for 9.5 months when I was a grad student in a 10-by-10 room. And I was able to arrange the bed and the dresser and the bookcases and the movable table that I had to have, in effect, 3 different rooms mm-hmm. within 100 square feet by 8 feet high, so 80 cubic feet. And it worked out very well. And that was a very interesting experience. That was, in a way, a transformative experience. Had I gone to graduate school in, I don't know, Texas, and lived in a 4,000 square foot apartment with 5 other guys, space would not have been constrained. But because I was in Cambridge, in a tiny little room, I had to make the best.
Now I'm going to guess you also...
It intrigued my sense of, or it inspired, or it sparked a sense of inquiry of what can you do given whatever circumstance you're in. Go ahead.
It also sparks, I think, another type of positive inquiry, which is what do we need and want in our lives and what truly makes us feel good, mm-hmm. makes us happier. You know, most of us have way too much stuff in our homes. You know, look at the expansion of storage spaces.
Now you're going down the line of thought that old man Wright had, where, you know, in Frank Lloyd Wright house, there are practically no closets because he said, you don't need that stuff. You just need a few wonderful things. You don't need all these clothes. So he just refused to provide closet space in his houses. So you're on to, you're just channeling, a wonderful train of thought, which is practically Zen. And by the way, the early prairie houses came out of his having seen the Japanese pavilion at the Columbian Exposition of 1893.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. He saw it, and he saw the flow of space.
The configurable open spaces.
Yes, mm-hmm. and it changed everything for him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, but, yeah, exactly. And the question is, will people listen to us? We're just architects.
Yeah.
Fashion says you need more stuff every year, different stuff.
Right, and the economy says that too.
Yeah, although there have been some exceptions where architects who are really good industrial designers, architecturally inclined industrial designers, try to produce something that people would have and it would be good for 10, 20, or so years, and you wouldn't need to buy more of it. But it tended to be priced a little higher because, for example, do you remember the Heller mugs of the 1970s? They were made out of ABS plastic, and and they were very Bauhausy, and they probably were good for 15 years. They were kind of pricey, but they were beautiful in their simplistic way. Now, if you bought a whole kitchen set of Heller mugs and plates and bowls, you'd probably be able to keep them for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And if you were into the aesthetic of that simplicity, be very happy. But one was you had to be inculcated into the beauty of it. And two, not throw it out after 3 or 4 years because it was plastic. So education becomes a very huge thing. And I don't see our educational system providing any sort of aesthetic education. The public schools have cut out art, and they've cut out science. Those are extraneous.
Science, amazing. I get sort of the point of view about art. I don't agree with it, but cutting out science is...
Well, science is whatever the minimum needs to be. Yes, arithmetic's there, but even arithmetically, we're falling behind.
That's why Clinton has to tell us to do the arithmetic.
Well, science is under attack because there are people who strenuously, on a political level, wish to teach the Bible, and which means we can't talk about geology. Can't talk about something that's a million years old, a million-year-old trilobite that you find in a fossil, because that don't work in terms of Genesis.
Yeah, never mind where fossil fuels came from.
Right. I mean, it's unfortunate. It's sad, but it's a reality presently that we've got technologically the most advanced society.
Well, what we have, I think, is an eco-illiterate society.
Yes.
And I've actually had a lot of discussions about this.
I'm glad you got it around to eco. Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
How about turning out the lights? Or?
Or how about understanding where that electricity comes from?
Yeah.
You know, where the light bulb comes from? What had to come out of the earth to make that?
Yeah.
And what is it worth to us? You know, what are the systems of the earth, of our ecosystems that produce these materials and these services that we rely on but take for granted? And if we had more consciousness about that, we'd be changing our values.
We would.
I'd like to think so.
I mean, the wonder, just to veer off a little bit, the wonder of a pencil. A pencil that has graphite mixed with clay in a cedar sheath is a wonder of industrial creation.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it would be difficult for us, knowing what we know, to recreate that with hand tools.
Yeah.
You know?
How many of us could even think about it?
I being a technology wonk, kind of sort of think that I could make a halfway good pencil if I had access to cedar logs and lamp plank and
but the point I don't think is
or some charcoal and clay, but we take all of these things for granted, and therefore we waste those resources. Is that your point?
Yeah, it's part of it. I mean, I think, you know, I may look at things a little bit differently than another person. I look at a traffic jam of cars, and certainly I see the problems of the traffic jam and the highway and all that. But I also think, look at all that material that went into all of those cars. Where did it come from, and where is it going to? You know, if you try to imagine all the cars we've made and all the buildings we've built, all that stuff comes out of the earth somehow, right? And gets transformed somehow into these things that we no longer recognize their origins of. And then it gets thrown away somehow so that we have to dig up some more and make some more. And I don't think we have any relationship to that system.
No, none. When I'm stuck in a traffic jam, I think of all the wasted time the people sitting there unable to do anything.
Yeah.
And, lately, it's exceptionally dangerous for people to be tweeting their frustration or looking up a lunch menu on their handheld thing in traffic while they're operating a motor vehicle. So that's not really a benefit to not being able to travel.
Which gets us back to the whole point of what have we gained?
And who was to benefit?
That's right. Yeah, so you
big industry was to benefit, but the small town environment, the neighborhood, took a beating.
Yeah,
people don't just go out for a walk and say hello to people. A couple of weeks ago, I went down to see an art opening in Princeton. I took the train down. I walked from the Princeton station, taking the Dinky train.
Yeah.
And the location for this opening was a little cafe in what some people might think was a sketchy neighborhood. It was a mixed race neighborhood. It was not the Princetonians. It was over 5 or 6 blocks. But it was a neighborhood where people still had porches.
Mm-hmm.
It was a neighborhood that had been so poor that it had not been redeveloped. And I felt very comfortable because when I was growing up, my grandparents, some of my grandparents, lived in southern Indiana, and people walked around, and if you walked past someone on the porch, you said, hello. You acknowledged your humanity.
Yeah.
You said hello because it was polite. We're all here.
Well, this is this idea of community that I've, you know, we've talked about a few times here. And I mentioned I lived on the same block for 30 years, and I absolutely love this block because I walk outside. First of all, I walk down my stairs of my walk-up building. I know most of the people in the building. We're, you know, all in this together. We're in a condo. We talk about things. But I go out on the street, and then I know the owners of the stores and the restaurants on the block. If it's nighttime, I'm walking the dog. I stop to talk to the bouncers who are looking out for us if need be. And I have never gone outside of my block and not spoken with someone and not, you know, bumped into neighbors. And that didn't happen in the suburban bedroom community I grew up in. It's a whole different kind of community that I absolutely love.
And so would you say, as architects, mm-hmm. that is what we should be promoting going forward?
Well, I would say yes, but hesitantly. And the hesitancy is that...
Why? Why not?
Because we can't approach this as a one-size-fits-all solution. I know plenty of people that really, truly love their greater isolation or independence or don't want to be that close in dwelling to others. And I don't think we can force that on everybody.
No. You could be the man who always draws his drapes on his house and never comes out on his porch.
Yes, or you could just, instead of having to draw the drapes and not go out on the porch, just live further apart, if that's what you like.
Or as I see a trend, you could be like the people of my children's generation who want the interaction.
Yeah.
Or you could stay in the suburbs.
Well, here's
which suggests that suburbs might devolve into a bunch of hermits.
Yeah. Here's my point again, bring it back to the American way of life.
But is that healthy? Is that healthy? Is that American way of life healthy?
Is it healthy, and is it something we've really chosen? And I don't think we have. I think we
originally we chose it, but now?
I don't even think we originally chose it. I think it came about because of subsidies and federal programs. And in that sense, we were manipulated by what we would now call a nanny state into doing things that became this American way of life. I'm not sure that we actually chose this American way of life. I think we were pushed and manipulated into it.
How very funny. The Eisenhower administration as a nanny state. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
I think we've run out of our allotted time. I've been speaking with David Bergman, architect and thinker of big thoughts. This is Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.